Major support for Louisiana Eats comes from Zatarain's Hot Sauce. Memorial Day cookout recipes available at Zatarain's.com. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Just who doesn't like Chinese food? Wait, what really is Chinese food after all? On this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, we're having a full-on Asian excursion. First, author Audra Ang explains why in China, to the people, food is heaven, the name of her first book. As a journalist in mainland China, Audra worked as a field reporter from the wreckage of the Great Sichuan Earthquake, which took place exactly 10 years ago this week. Audra joins us to recall her 2008 voyage from heaven to hell. Then, we'll explore why Chinese food is heaven to an overwhelming majority of U.S. citizens with UC Irvine professor Yang Chen and Chinese cooking teacher and author Xiaoqing Chao. I've been cooking her Chinese soul food since the book arrived, and it's delicious. Finally, we're going to bend the rules and blur the lines with a dim sum soup dumpling class from Chef Michael Galata. So start the rice cooker and get out your chopsticks for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Singapore-born Audra Ang worked as a Beijing correspondent for the Associated Press from 2002 through 2009. After years of traversing China and meeting its people, she published her experiences in a book, To the People, Food is Heaven. One of the book's most haunting chapters begins on May 12, 2008, when a devastating magnitude 8.0 earthquake rocked the Sichuan province. I asked Audra what it was like to be there in the aftermath of such a catastrophic event.
I probably shouldn't say this, but I always tell people that if you want to read my book and you can't get through it, just read the last chapter, because the last chapter is about the earthquake, and it is the chapter that's closest to my heart. I'm not a war correspondent. You know, I was general news, and so I didn't see a lot of death and destruction. So the earthquake was probably the most gut-wrenching, intense experience I had while reporting in China. I was in another province when it happened, and we managed to fly and get there the day after the earthquake. And I was based there for a total of like 5 weeks in and out. And it was, you know, my voice still kind of starts shaking when I talk about it, because I had never seen that much destruction in one place. You know, just in a few seconds, entire villages were wiped out. I think almost 90,000 people were killed and missing. And there were a few moments from my time there that pretty much will stay with me forever. One of them was, I was based a lot in one of the worst hit villages outside of the epicenter. And it was called Beichuan. And we were walking around. And when I looked down, when we were walking around, I would see rubble, chunks of concrete, big and small. You see nails and screws and broken glass and, you know, sometimes very personal items like toys or, you know, shoes, clothes, items of clothing. It's just pretty much a sea of debris that reflected the life that was there before. And I remember it was really hot because it was in May and it was in Sichuan province, and it was hot and humid, kind of like being in Louisiana. And we were walking under the sun and trying to avoid, you know, twists of metal, you know, rusty things, and trying not to fall or cut yourself. And the wind shifted, and the smell of a dead body is something that you never forget. And I caught a whiff of that, and I realized that I was probably walking on people who had died, who were buried under there. And it was just kind of a, I don't know, it just hit me in a strange way because I was, you know, part of me was like, I got to tell the story. Another part is like, should I be digging through rubble trying to find them? Another part is like, just feeling helpless and horrified. We went to another town that was really hard hit, and there were, you know, dozens and dozens of bodies laid out in a school kind of athletic field. And I had never seen that many dead bodies, you know, all together at once. And they were covered, and there was a team of, you know, I guess workers or medical workers, or I'm not sure who they were, but they were dressed in scrubs. They were covered up, and they were kind of quote unquote processing the bodies because they were wrapping them in saran wrap and making sure that, you know, they were covered up, and there were relatives everywhere, and they were, you know, trying to identify their loved ones, and, you know, they weren't all covered. You could see the top of someone's head with, you know, their hair is covered in dust, or their feet with just like one shoe that was left on. And I, you know, it was hard. There was no, the getting cell reception was really hard, but, you know, that's how we would operate in the field. Like, we called the main office in Beijing, kind of gave them the detail or dictate a story. And I finally got through after several tries, and my news editor, Scott, answered. And I took a breath to kind of tell him what I saw, but what came out were just like huge sobs. It took me by surprise, but I think I just like, I didn't realize it, but I was just crying. And Scott, who was like a sweetheart, he started tearing up on the other end. And I remember him telling me, just breathe, just breathe. And I did. And then I told him, you know, what I saw. And at that same field, I met a father and a son. And he, I mean, what do you say to someone after this? And, you know, I have to ask the really basic question. How do you feel? Tell me your story. You know, what happened? You know, and I remember him telling us, telling me the story of how his wife had been trapped under rubble. And he waited and dug. He and his son tried to help her and tried to help her. But in the end, they had to give up and had to leave her to die. And, you know, as he told the story, he couldn't look me in the eye. I mean, again, how do you deal with that? And so, I mean, and there are just many, many moments like that, which will just live with me for a long time.
It reminds me in so many ways of things that we experienced on a different scale here during Hurricane Katrina. How did it go for you living in that?
So it took us a while when we were living in the actual zone that, you know, still had aftershocks. It took us a while to find a place that would take us in, and we just got really basic rooms. And yeah, there wasn't much electricity or water. You know, infrastructure was, I mean, spotty. We could barely make calls on our cell phone. And so it was very basic. And in some ways, that's kind of what I wanted, because I didn't want to live in luxurious quarters when everyone else is living in tents on the street or, you know, digging through their garden to find a potato so they could eat. There wasn't much food. We ate a lot of instant noodles. But actually, food was a big thing because that's, you know, the book was about food and Chinese experience. And so in some ways, you know, a lot of people didn't eat after the earthquake because, number one, there was no food. But number two, their spirits were broken. I mean, you can't eat, you know, after experiencing something like that. And that was in some ways like there was a child, a lot of schools, more than normal schools, collapsed because, you know, there was a whole other issue and a lot of children died. And I remember meeting a mother and her son, and, you know, they were in one of the makeshift tents, and he had been injured, but not as badly as some other kids I'd interviewed, but his face was all scratched up and he was listless. But his mom was saying that, yeah, I mean, he refused to eat after the earthquake, and then slowly maybe he had some porridge or something. But just that morning, he had asked for his favorite food, which was KFC. So that's how she that's how she knew that his spirit was recovering, because he was finally hungry and finally eating. And another moment that kind of broke my heart was there were a lot of makeshifts, like kind of communities with tents, you know, like for people who didn't have homes anymore. And I remember coming across a woman one day, and she was like frying something up in a wok, and it was like pork basically. And I'm, again, like, how do you talk to someone who has lost so much? But I remember asking, you know, how are you doing or something. She wouldn't respond, and just one tear kind of slid down her cheek as she was cooking. And another lady, same thing, kind of in another tent community, she was frying up dinner, and she's like, we have to eat to live. This is what you do. This is how you survive. And so there was a whole like gamut, like a whole range of responses, and, you know, kind of how food fed the spirit of people. There were also lots of volunteers who came to the area, and they would cook up meals, and there would be lines of, you know, displaced people, you know, with holding bowls and, you know, trying to get a scoop of food. And so, I don't know, there was just so many ways to express things through food. And, you know, I didn't think of it then, but, you know, writing the book, I kind of figured out that's the way that kind of shows the spirit being fed and how people came back through food.
Was there any moment where somebody offered to share something with you and you thought, how in the world could you share?
Yes. There was one moment where there was a town that had been blocked. It actually was the first town I was talking about where it had been destroyed. And it was really hard to get to because it's in a valley and you had to like go up this like crazy road. But anyway, we started walking and then we're trying to hitch rides on like motorcycles. Those were the only things that could get through. And I remember hearing people yelling and I was like, what's going on? And it turns out that it was people from homes that were along the mountainside yelling at people because they had water and they were offering bottles of water to people that were going up to that village. And, you know, water is obviously scarce at a time like this. And so, again, it just blew my mind that, you know, they were trying to help people that way, just in a very simple way, just offering water. And actually, yeah, there were a couple of times where I went to these camps where people were cooking and, you know, I was really hungry, but obviously I'm not going to be like, can I have your food? But, you know, there were a couple of families who like forced me to sit down to eat with them because, you know, they were like, just come eat with us. We have a ton of food.
Audra, have you been back to China? And if so, did you follow up with any of the people you met at that time?
I went back to the quake zone for the 6-month anniversary and the one year anniversary. And I did follow up on one story in particular about a little kid, a little boy, who had survived his school collapsing, but he was trapped under rubble and he had to have both arms amputated. And of course, you know, he was a beautiful boy, but of course he was one of those kids who used his hands a lot. Like his mom told me a story of how he used to like to carve little toys for his friends, you know, and that kind of thing. He was just a little boy who loved to use his hands, like which little boy doesn't. But he didn't talk the first time I met him. And apparently he hadn't talked at that time since he escaped.
How old was he when you first met him?
He was probably maybe 11, I think. And then I went back a year later. And so I went back a year later. And after the first story ran, actually, I think we got a lot of queries on like how people, you know, from people who had read the story, how they could help him. And I think because things were crazy, I mean, I was on the road all the time. I'm not sure. I didn't really follow up on that. And, you know, other people did. But he eventually got prosthetics for both arms. And I think someone had donated them. And so I met him a year later and he had kind of become like a surly teenager. he wore his prosthetics, but he didn't actually like wearing them because, number one, they were kind of uncomfortable. And secondly, he said he felt that, you know, people looked at him weird when he did. Mm-hmm. And he had, you know, of course he was talking but he still, you know, he was never the same again. And his parents, you know, had to move and, you know, had to try and get a job to pay for things. And so I think that whole area in record time, you know, things were cleaned up, new homes were built. But I think the emotional and psychological scars, you know, will remain for a long time.
Audra, thank you so much for giving us your account, your memories of that terrible, terrible time. And I certainly hope everybody will read your book, To the People, Food is Heaven, because your book is a little slice of heaven for everybody. Thank you, Audra.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you saying that. I really, really appreciate this time that I've had with you.
Audra Ong, AP correspondent and author of To the People, Food is Heaven. When we come back from a short break, we learn the story of how Chinese food became one of America's most beloved cuisines. Louisiana Eats returns in a moment. Coffee Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets, from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and Ralph Brennan's Redfish Grill, from Dock to Pot, offering 9 varieties of fresh Gulf fish daily. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 115 Bourbon Street in the French Quarter. Are you podcasting Louisiana Eats yet? If not, it's time to subscribe. We've launched an exclusive podcast series, Louisiana Eats Quick Bites, made up of sneak previews of material that hasn't hit the airwaves yet and full-length interviews never heard on the show before. Don't miss a minute of our delicious programming. So subscribe today on our podcast page at poppytooker.com. That way, you won't miss a single serving of our broadcast or our Quick Bites podcasts. And now, back to Louisiana Eats.
My name is Yong Chen. I'm a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine.
Chinese food is beloved in America, across all racial and socioeconomic lines. Since the 1980s, it's officially been the most popular ethnic cuisine in the U.S. Currently, there are nearly 50,000 Chinese restaurants across America. Compare that to McDonald's, which has only 15,000. In his book, Chop Suey USA, Yang explains the evolution of Chinese restaurants in the U.S., from their introduction in the 19th century to its future in the 21st.
Chinese cuisine arrived with the coming of the first Chinese 49ers, you know, the people who came from the Pearl River Delta region in South China during and shortly after the Gold Rush. So in the mid-19th century. And so the first Chinese restaurants, there were 4 of them at least, you know, appeared in San Francisco in the late 1840s. At that time, you know, the people in San Francisco, you know, most of them were young males coming from different parts of the world, and from the East Coast, from South America, you know, from China, from other places. They were hungry. They were hungry for money, but also hungry for food, because these young men didn't know how to cook. So some of them probably went to those Chinese restaurants, okay? But very shortly thereafter, anti-Chinese sentiments started to increase and became very, very strong during the 1850s. People attacked the Chinese, and when they did that, they also attacked their culture, their food. So, you know, commentators, customers frequently used adjectives like repulsive to describe Chinese food. You know, that kind of adjectives remained very popular in descriptions of Chinese food almost throughout the second half of the 19th century. So Chinese restaurants retreated and then remained within the boundaries of Chinese communities. You know, Chinatown, San Francisco, Sacramento, Marysville, and later on, Los Angeles. And the customers of Chinese restaurants were primarily Chinese. The Chinese immigrants, Chinese Americans themselves, who supported.
And at some point, you know, you mentioned Chinese Americans. At some point, is that how the food becomes accepted? It becomes more Americanized?
That's a good question. It's really a complicated story. You know, people like me have just started to look into the complexities in terms of why, you know, and how Chinese food did become popular. There are a number of factors. You know, the first one is the rise of Chinatown as a tourist attraction. You know, that happened around the turn of the 20th century. In major cities, almost throughout the U.S., there are other social economic factors, one of which is the fact that the Chinese, in the course of the second half of the 19th century, were marginalized in terms of occupational choices. So they were driven out of the mines, and after the completion of the railroad, thousands of Chinese railroad workers lost their jobs, and they were also driven out of rural America by violence. Okay, so and they were banned from various occupations. Could not become lawyers. Could not become teachers. So the only sector that was that remained open was the service industry. Throughout American history, the essence of the American dream is focused on the quality of life, a better life. Okay, so having the ability of your meals served and cooked by somebody else, you know, that's something very important in the mind of a lot of people, and that's why you know the restaurant industry started to rise. And the Chinese took advantage of this opportunity. Even to this day, you know, Chinese food in the minds of a lot of people remains a sort of inexpensive, cheap, and convenient kind of food. You can say Chinese food was the predecessor of American fast food.
Yang. There we are in the early part of the 20th century, and through the chop suey craze and phenomenon, the cuisine takes hold. But then World War II comes along, and that must have changed the scene tremendously when it came to Chinese food in America.
It's a very, very good point. World War II was a turning point. There has been a sort of a racial hierarchy. In the U.S., you know, it's a kind of a ideology that prevailed in popular culture, also in government policies, and in the documents issued by the federal government. Okay, so in that hierarchy, the Chinese ranked very, very low. Okay, they used to, but in World War II, their quote unquote ranking started to rise. In that hierarchy, so for example, then they all of a sudden they became sort of a better people, you know, a superior race in comparison with the Japanese. Okay, so some Chinese Americans carried a badge on them saying, "I am Chinese," or "I am not Japanese." And China and the U.S. were friends during World War II. So this is why when conflict became more serious in the Pacific Theater in 1943, the U.S. government repealed the longstanding anti-Chinese exclusion act. There were several of them. The first one was passed back in 1882, banning Chinese labor immigration for 10 years and reaffirming the legal principle, which goes back to 1790, that no Chinese could become naturalized American citizens. So, you know, the Chinese effectively took advantage of that opportunity. They showcased their culture during holidays, like the Chinese New Year. So they invited in cities like San Francisco and New York, you know, their Caucasian neighbors to join them in their community. So there were Chinese folk dances, Chinese music, and also Chinese food.
Well, thank you so much for taking us down this historical path with you. What do you think we can look for on the horizon, Yang?
One hope that I have is, you know, people now will have a greater opportunity to taste a greater variety of Chinese regional cuisines, right? But also the fine dining kinds of Chinese food, beautifully presented, delicious, artistic, the best that the world's one of the oldest and the most sophisticated cuisine has to offer.
That was Yang Chen, professor of history at the University of California at Irvine, and author of Chop Suey USA, The Story of Chinese Food in America.
My name is Xiaoqing Chow, and I am the author of Chinese Soul Food, and I also teach cooking in Seattle here at Hot Stove Society.
Xiaoqing Chow's love of journalism and cooking sprouted from a seed planted long ago by her parents. Immigrants from Taiwan, they sought to further their education and make a better life for their children here in America. When Xiaoqing was just a girl, they opened a Chinese restaurant to help support their journalism studies and their family. Xiaoqing's childhood love of journalism and food transformed into a career writing cookbooks and teaching cooking. Her book, Chinese Soul Food, is remarkable on many levels and is absolutely one of my favorites. The cooking teacher in Xiaoqing really shows in her recipes for everyone's favorite Chinese restaurant dishes, like pork spare ribs and chili wontons, which she demystifies using ingredients you're likely to already have in your pantry. We spoke with Xiaoqing about how this all came about.
Well, I wanted to create a book that would be more inclusive of the, most diverse audience of home cooks, because I feel like anymore everything is about what very special, precious experience we can have, or what celebrity can have a book, and you know, how beautiful is it, how comprehensive is it, and I just wanted something that was practical that people would actually take into the kitchen and cook from it.
I love that you refer to what you do, and you also named your book Chinese Soul Food. What does that mean to you?
It's that these foods, these recipes, they're everyday Chinese home cooking, and most Chinese families will have some version of these dishes. You know, it's kind of like in America, it might be fried chicken and mac and cheese, where everybody's got their slightly different version, but they're all good. Same thing, like the green beans or the wontons or the dumplings. You know, there's a basic method for making these foods, but maybe your grandma liked it with a little more ginger or a little more spice, or, you know, you name it. So there's some variation, but if you asked people about these dishes, they will wax poetic about these foods, because it hits you at the core, and usually if you had a bad day, you're like, yeah, I need a bowl of noodle soup, or I need a bowl of congee, or, you know, if you're sick, oh, I need to have some of that chicken soup. You know, they unify us across all the different regions and all across the, if I may borrow another term, the diaspora of Chinese people who are around the world. And by the way, there's a Chinese restaurant in every town anywhere in the world. So it just kind of, it's that food that, you know, it's not fussy. It just comforts you, and you know that you're home.
One of the things that you accomplished with all gold stars, as far as I'm concerned, you set out to write straightforward recipes inspired by foods of your childhood. And, you know, I've been cooking or attempting to cook or fascinated by Chinese food my whole life. And, you know, I hail back from a time before there were any Asian markets, and these ingredients were quite obscure. And I'm fascinated that again and again, I read one of your recipes, and there doesn't seem to be any need for any exotic ingredients.
Well, I think that we somehow in this culture feel that to be special or to be, quote, authentic, we have to go to the ends of the earth to find the most authentic ingredients that were grown in, you know, the villages of the Sichuan province or whatever it is. And while you know, that search for the most authentic flavors is not inherently a bad pursuit, it is not practical. If you live in the middle of the country, you know, the middle of Missouri or wherever it is, like, you just don't have that kind of access. But the beauty of this kind of cooking, this just the spirit of traditional Chinese cooking, is that you can take these methods and adapt it to whatever ingredients you have wherever you are. So a stir fry is a stir fry, whether you have Chinese cabbage or baby bok choy or you have kale. Okay, so it's a green vegetable. You can still apply the techniques of stir frying, the techniques of balancing flavors. So, you know, it's more about if you have something that's hot, sour, salty, sweet, there are different ways to achieve that balance. So like with the spare rib dish that you're talking about, you know, traditionally it's made with Chinese black vinegar and rock sugar. Well, if you don't have Chinese black vinegar and rock sugar, how are you going to get that acidity in that sugar? Well, you can use brown sugar. It's not the same. I'm not equating it to rock sugar, but I'm just saying you're still getting that rich sweetness. And then if you don't have the Chinese black vinegar, you know, you probably have some balsamic vinegar. Use that instead.
What is your essential Chinese pantry?
I have to have soy sauce. I mean, and I talk a little bit about this, but, you know, in America, we kind of rely on the most familiar brand, which is probably Kikkoman, which is a Japanese brand, and there's nothing wrong with it, but it's one soy sauce, and it's Japanese.
That's almost like saying there's only one kind of wine, huh?
Right, exactly. So it's like, you know, you don't just say, hey, I need wine in the house. You say, well, what kind of wine? There's, you know, there's white, there's red, and then within that, there's old world, new, you know, on and on, different regions, different styles, oaked, unoaked. Same kind of thing with soy sauce. Not that I don't want people to think that they must have a certain brand or a certain style. I just want people to notice that, A, there are different types of soy sauce. They have different flavors. And from Asian cuisine to Asian cuisine, the general flavor profiles are different. So Chinese soy sauce is different from Japanese soy sauce, is different from Thai or Vietnamese sauces. So if you understand nothing else, just know that there are differences. And then, you know, like in Southeast Asia, the soy sauces tend to be sweeter. In Japan, sometimes they're more refined because they like to serve it with raw fish. There's just stylistically, they're different flavors and they're used for different purposes. So what I recommend is if you are going to do any, you know, a little bit more Chinese cooking, then look for a Chinese soy sauce. And when you're buying soy sauce, make sure that the label says that it's naturally fermented and brewed. So then you know that it was, that they took the time to actually develop the flavor of the soy sauce, and it wasn't just chemically produced in a factory, you know, for the masses.
Now, what about cooking equipment? Because maybe you don't have a lot of special, maybe you don't have a wok, maybe you don't have a steamer. It's okay, huh?
Yeah. So you can jerry-rig a steamer. Now, if you want to be serious about stir-frying, you should get a wok. But let me say that you don't need to spend a whole lot of money on a wok. So get a carbon steel wok. You shouldn't spend more than, say, $30, $35 at the top. Now, if you don't have the space, some people have small kitchens. Maybe they don't cook Chinese food that often. You know, there are a lot of dishes that don't require a wok at all. And then if you really just want to put some vegetables together, I'm not going to penalize you for using a saute pan. Because, again, I want you to get in the kitchen and cook. So if you use the recipes but you don't have exactly the right equipment, still make the food. And at some point, my hope is that they'll love this food enough that they do want to commit to buying some of the pieces of equipment. And really, it's so basic. If you have a wok, you can do so many things with it.
This is the Chinese cookbook I've been looking for my whole life, because every single one of my favorite dishes that I ever eat out anywhere in a Chinese restaurant, or they're all there. They're all there. And it's just a treasure. I'm tickled to have it. And I hope everybody will avail themselves of your book, because I think it's a must-have.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. That is music to my ears.
Well, I mean it. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate your time as well.
That was Xiaoqing Chao, author of Chinese Soul Food. Which commonplace savory Louisiana ingredient is a favorite dessert component in Asia? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Which commonplace savory Louisiana ingredient is a favorite dessert component in Asia? Okay, that was a bit of a trick question. If you guessed red beans, you're right. Sort of. You see, in many Asian cuisines, a little red bean known as an adzuki bean is used in various desserts. You'll often see red bean paste sold in Asian groceries. That's made with adzuki beans, not our kidneys. That said, some people claim that you can use them interchangeably, but adzuki beans have a natural sweetness that red kidney beans don't. So, if you try that, you'll probably need to add some extra sugar. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
My name is Michael Glotta. My restaurants are Maypop and Mofo. Mofo being the older one, and then Maypop being the new baby of the family.
If there's a single way to illustrate the influence Southeast Asian cooking has had on Louisiana cuisine, Michael Galata's food just might be it. When he opened Mofo in New Orleans Mid-City in 2014, he amazed diners with his artful combinations of traditional Vietnamese and Louisiana ingredients. By 2016, Food & Wine magazine pegged him as one of America's best chefs. In 2017, Michael opened a second restaurant in New Orleans Market District, Maypop, which boasts a delectable weekend dim sum brunch. At Maypop, Michael continues to blur the lines on where Southeast Asia ends and South Louisiana begins.
I always love the fact that New Orleans sort of assimilates all of its cultures.
Yeah.
I love the fact that, like, if you go to any New Orleans restaurant, if you go to a New Orleans Italian restaurant, it's always New Orleans first and Italian second.
True.
But the Vietnamese culture is so new that they were still very traditional. Every one of their restaurants is very traditional. And now it's changing.
Yeah.
Just in the last 5 years, 4 years, even since MoFo opened. Now you see a lot of younger, second and third generation Vietnamese men and women opening restaurants that are more New Orleans with their Vietnamese heritage mixed in. So that's sort of what MoFo was when we opened it. We said, how can we make a New Orleans restaurant that has Vietnamese influences? It's not a Vietnamese restaurant. I think that's something that we run into. People are like, well, this isn't Vietnamese. Like, yeah, I know it's not Vietnamese. I'm a guy from New Orleans. I just grew up with a lot of Vietnamese friends going to their houses and eating ban chao crepes and all these things. And so I loved eating it growing up, but obviously it's not my culture. So this is my culture. This is New Orleans cuisine through that lens.
This is one of the things I know that really turned my head about your new restaurant, because I am a dim sum lover. And that's something we really don't see a lot of here in New Orleans anyway.
I think that was the whole idea. You know, I think the same with when we opened MoFo, you know, we wanted to sort of fill that void in that area that we were in. So, like, you know, no one was roasting whole animals. No one was doing all these curries from scratch and grinding them by hand in mortar and pestles. And so it's like one of those things that I just craved, and I couldn't really find it anywhere unless I wanted to drive way into the deep West Bank or something like that. I couldn't find it in the city proper. And so that's why we opened MoFo in Mid-City. And so it's sort of the same thing with Maypop. We opened it up, and, you know, our first sort of Saturday, Sunday, we were sitting there and we weren't really busy yet. And I was like, man, we should do a brunch. I'm like, but, you know, coming up in the industry, you don't want to do brunch because brunch is brunch. And we're like, what can we do that's really fun? And I'm like, man, no one, except for on the West Bank or, you know, no one really does dim sum. So we said, well, how can we bring dim sum to downtown? And that kind of became the catchphrase, you know, downtown dim sum.
Downtown dim sum.
And so so the idea was, how do we still sort of keep the same vein of using local products to make really cool dim sum dishes? Because I think because I'm New Orleanian, I still cook with a heavy hand.
Right.
And you still see a lot of, like, traditional people will come in. Vietnamese or Chinese will come in and eat here, even at MoFo and Maypop, and they're like, well, it's very heavy. And I think that's the New Orleans in me.
Yeah.
But the New Orleanians come in and say, oh, it's so light. So I think that's sort of we sort of get stuck in that dichotomy of, like, we're neither. We're neither Southeast Asian, nor are we New Orleans. We're some sort of new hybrid. And so I love it. Like, every time, it's like, oh, it's like really rich, even though there's not one speck of cream or butter in anything. It's all coconut milk. So the Southeast Asians, who, like, Vietnamese food is very, very light, and they don't actually use a lot of coconut milk unless it's in desserts. Whereas the Thai use a lot more coconut milk for their curries, but still they don't use as much as I use, because I, like, reduce it down almost like we reduce, like, I was trained to reduce cream down in all the classical New Orleans recipes where you reduce cream down to this heavy sauce because that's just the way we cook. So I reduce all the coconut milk down because that's what I'm used to. And it's hard to break out of that mold.
So is there one particular Asian culture that you are channeling here at Maypop?
No, because not really, because dim sum is Southern Chinese more than Southeast Asian. And then, you know, a lot of this food has more Thai influence than Vietnamese influence. And then even some of our house-made sambals and things like that, like, we have a pork hock dish on right now, and it has a pineapple sambal on top, but that's an Indonesian sambal recipe, where you use, like, really funky shrimp pastes and caramelize it down with palm sugar and tamarind water. But then we put it over a pot liquor made with coconut milk and smoked ham hocks. So it's like,
you get so much going
on. And sometimes I feel like I'm pushing myself over the fringe here. But
how do you dream this stuff up? When do you think these things?
Well, with the pork hog dish, literally, my friends at Chopped Peel Farms are like, hey, Mike, we just slaughtered a bunch of hogs. We have all these pork hocks, and no one wanted them. And so I'm always kind of the goat of the restaurant industry. Whenever the local farms have things they can't move, they drop them off to me, and I try to figure out something to do with them.
Oh, it's like the commercial ad. Give him the Mikey. He'll eat them. Is that how that goes?
So when I first got the pork hocks, I was like, oh, we're going to do something really clean, like this really nice risotto milanese, but we'll use sticky rice, and then we'll make almost like an ossobuco with the pork hock over the top. And I was like, man, I'm still in South Louisiana, so we're going to make a pot liquor, we're gonna braise these guys, slow braise them in coconut milk with smoked pork hocks in there as well. So make this really rich pot liquor, but add the coconut milk to it to add a little creaminess. We'll throw in some local field peas, and then we're gonna, after we finish braising those pork cocks, we're just gonna drop them right in the deep fryer. And so the skin on the outside just gets all crackling. So we put this, and we add some local collard greens, so we have this collard green and field pea pot liquor underneath. We still add a little bit of vinegar, just like you would to a traditional pot liquor. Put the pork hock on top, and I was like, well, I need something like really just to kick it over the top. So we made a pineapple sambal, which is a dish that we developed over in Mofo. My chef de cuisine, Paul, over there, who actually, he does travel to Indonesia and Southeast Asia every summer. And so this is a recipe that he brought back for this really awesome Indonesian sambal. And so we smoked pineapples and folded this spicy sambal with the pineapples and then topped that on top of this pork hock. So you have like funky, sweet, smoky on top. You have really rich, crackling pork hock. And then you have this smoky pot liquor with local collard greens and field peas and just a little bit of coconut milk to make it rich. And then so suddenly you have this dish that's everything and nothing.
Yum! It's everything and nothing. If you had to explain to the people who are great lovers and frequenters of Mofo, how is Maypop different?
Maypop really brings in more of my Italian upbringing. So we have a whole noodle section that we don't have at Mofo. You know, we can do the prettier plate-ups. It's like nicer stemware, higher-end wines.
It's a little more fine dining.
Right, it's a little more fine dining.
With the same sensibilities.
Exactly.
And you're getting to show off your Galata heritage
here. And I get to show off my Galata heritage. Because we have a pasta machine. Like two, we make fresh and dried pastas in-house, like pounds and pounds of fresh-made pasta every day. But we toss them with all these funky ingredients and coconut milks and curries and house-made charcuteries.
Michael, how'd you figure this out? Have you been to Southeast Asia?
That's always the big joke, is that I have not. And I just grew up with a lot of friends. A lot of Southeast Asian friends, because growing up in New Orleans, we have a huge community. But the dim sum I didn't learn until much later in life. You know, not until I started traveling to New York and San Francisco and things like that, where people started, you gotta go try this, because we don't have it in New Orleans.
Right.
You know, there's only a few places that do it, and you know as well as I, unless you're really, really popular, no one's gonna really go try it. So
yeah.
We just aren't known for it.
This thing that you have learned, this is entirely self-taught.
Right, exactly. So I'm sure I'm doing it wrong. But as long as people like to eat it, then I'm okay with it.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Michael Galata, chef and co-owner of Mofo and Maypop in New Orleans. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. If you're not podcasting yet, it's time to subscribe. We've launched an exclusive podcast series, Louisiana Eats Quick Bites, made up of sneak previews of material that hasn't hit the airwaves yet and full-length interviews never heard on the show before. Visit our podcast page at poppytooker.com so you won't miss a single serving of our broadcast or our podcast. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, Camellia Beans, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from the Palace Cafe, home of the weekend jazz brunch featuring a build-your-own Bloody Mary bar, located in the historic Whirline Music Building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.